Sarah Tabor, The Memoir Writer's Conundrum, Saturday, July 3rd.
I guess I'll get started. Can you all hear me back there? Can you hear me? Okay. Good. Well, thank you all for coming. I wrote this lecture for those of you who are caught up in the muddle of memoir as a sort of my offer of commiseration. I wanted to sort of warn you that I'm using the second person, but I don't mean to presume. It's just that second person seemed to just work for this, so you'll see what you think. So a tentative title for this is The Memoirist's Orphanage. The discovery of the right story in which to cast your life is almost always a struggle in memoir writing. And finding the story that works best is essential. It's what will make the writing hold together and the reader eager to take the journey. By relating the story of finding the story of my childhood, and by prompting you to reflect upon the stories that might best hold your material, I hope you may find courage for the sometimes difficult memoir writing process and more quickly grasp your own elusive tale. For once you have at last grasped, seized the driving line that works, you're quickly headed home. At first glance, mine seems a simple and straightforward enough tale. I was born in 1954 in Yokosuka, Japan. My father was a covert agent for the Central Intelligence Agency. And at the time, he was working on a hidden base in the Japanese hinterlands, a job that required my family to live under an assumed name. My father's shifting covert missions dictated the shape of my life as we moved from continent to continent, from Japan to the Philippines to Taiwan to Connecticut to Taiwan to Washington to the Netherlands to Washington to Borneo, and at 16 back to the country of my birth. To turn this into memoir doesn't seem so hard. You just set down what happened, right? And what could be more overt than the story of a spy's daughter? But locating the storyline that would hold it all is itself a long and arduous tale. For once you dare to enter the realm of memory, you find yourself in a quagmire of twisting roots and dead ends worthy of the most torturous spy thriller. You sit down at your desk and the confusion commences, and the din. For writing a memoir is like entering an orphanage, a room full of babies or bits of our experience clamoring, wanting to be picked up, wanting to be the chosen one, the only one. The mind, it turns out, is full of golems, ever deprived feeling parts of ourselves that want our full attention, to grab everything, the limelight, the gold ring, the power. The parts of us that are lost or were damaged, the emotional wrecks of us, are often the first to reach out their imploring arms. The agonized, the humiliated, the chastened, smushed peas of ourselves are the first to raise a ruckus when we try to start a memoir, as if we've never attended to them ad infinitum. It seems those parts of us can never get enough. Those unsettled, unresolved, unsorted ones, they want to capture the story. They want the whole book from cover to cover. That miserable you on those first days at new schools, you moved and were new so many times, where you stood at the edges of blacktops fighting tears. The you the popular girl didn't invite to her party. The you dumped by the guy at the Sadie Hawkins dance. Every experience of rejection or disappointment or grief will out. Each wants to be the whole book. You let them go on a while as you take down their dictations. And really, what relief and joy at slathering your misery copiously, luxuriantly as bread and butter on the page. But then, after a while, say a year or so, mustering your most commanding voice, you say, "Basta, that's not my whole life, shut up a while." Having had you devote yourself to them and seeing their names in print seems to calm the miserable ones down for a while, even to set smug little smirks on their faces, lets them agree to smallish parts, a long soliloquy, a second curtain call. It's good they've simmered down, for there are more yous in pain to be contended with who must be enjoined. That popular girl called Candy, who was the exact perfect, sassy, outgoing, cute girl, the one your mother hated, who you would have been from the fourth through eighth grades if you could only have figured out how to get a personality transplant. The one who betrayed you and who you followed around like a spaniel. The whole narrative could follow your evolving, sick, new girl, worshipful, one-down friendships with other girls. "Of course, me, yes, me," says Candy, grabbing the attention, as well as all the boys one more time. But you manage to wrestle her to the ground for the first time in your life. You only get a walk-on part, you say right to her face. What triumph. Memoir writing does offer deliciously wish fulfillment. More about girls, some readers say. Less, say others. The confusion remains all through the years of the writing, until maybe in the end you've got it right. Or perhaps it's insoluble, for one person will always want this and another that. Back to the writing, taking stock, you admit you are not constitutionally set up for sass. And now the shy girl, shyness in general, clamors for a large chunk of the cake. "The story could be an exploration of temperament and culture," she calmly explains, "how different cultures support different personality types. You're the perfect test case, having lived in so many countries. No one has emphasized this enough. Yes, that would be a good topic. Just think, you could research the Indian sense of self, rhapsodize about the Balinese. Thank goodness you're only waylaid for a month or two by this intriguing tack that wishes to take you far afield. How lovely a trip to Bali might be." But this is, after all, a memoir we're writing, isn't it? Note the we. The babies all this while are multiplying and kicking up dust. Returning to your desk from your day on the Balinese beach, you pat your anthropology training on the head, allow it a short rant in the sixth chapter, and dispatch it back to bed. But in some ways, she is right. The shy girl does have a right to her part in the story. She, after all, is basic. But basic truths don't always have to step forward and shout. They can just be like bones in a book. And furthermore, the shy girl doesn't have a right to rest the whole story because she was not all of you. There was the defiant rebel, the maverick, the bad ballerina, the lousy poet, and a lot of other girls too. The shy girl needs to be given a big nod, her rightful place, but just and only that. This is a democracy, after all, or is it? That's something perhaps to contemplate later. But that shy girl shuffling has roused another nearby baby, that pesky outsider you. All that blasted moving around and its lonely consequences wants to seize the story. You write passages like, "Kicking Dutch puddles on Anemoneweg after school on Friday of this first week, I can't even see myself in the dark pools. Who am I now?" And, "With the first day of school like a chilling fog all around me, the only clear answer I can come up with is, I am a person who's neither seen nor heard. I am a ghost." Loneliness, the search for belonging, this could be the vital thread of the story of your childhood. Or identity, belonging's twin. In Taiwan, I was a girl braving fear among water buffaloes. In Bethesda, a girl who chewed gum. Who will I be this time, you write further down the page. Who was I? Who am I? These are the fundamental questions of memoirists, and you are no exception. Might not the story be about your confusion, your two steps forward, one step back struggle over 18 years to secure a sturdy self? Or then again, perhaps the accent should be this, a tracing of your emotional growth, how you evolved from a sensitive little girl in Taiwan, scared of curious Chinese dowagers, to a brownie who prided herself on being stoical as a TV cowboy riding into the sunset, to a therapized hippie poetess in love with sentiment. Your book can be about your experiments in emotion and stoicism, you think. The baby of wriggling emotion claps its chubby hands from its cot. She knows she has a legitimate place in the book. The daughter of a spy, whose very identity in many ways is denied, has inevitably quite a story about feeling and its suppression. Oh, I can hear it. My listeners now are the ones who are clamoring. Their ears have perked up at the word spy. But not yet, I stoically reply. I've got other babies to tend to first. I know you want it now, but you have to wait. We'll get there. For there's a different sort of baby who has crawled into your arms. A figment of a girl is gazing into your eyes and has grabbed hold of your mind. She's an Asian girl, a beautiful, scrawny thing, the ideal friend you always longed for, who somehow embodies all for which you yearned. Though her hair is lacquer black and her eyes like brown polished stones, while yours are dirty blonde and green, she has your exact insides. She knows and affirms your every wish, validates your existence and your every move. She's your perfect match. This girl, whom your imagination has blended with a waif you latched onto at six on a fishy-smelling Taipei street, wants to have regular appearances every part step of your life. And furthermore, she announces, the book should be named after me. She is so happy at this thought that she twirls on the steppe land, which looks suspiciously like Mongolia, a place you've never been. You've always wanted to go to Mongolia, so for a year or two, you're in her thrall. Yes, I hate to say it, it can take years for a memoir to find its proper course. Until one day, your higher brain sternly reminds you, this is nonfiction. And you have to admit that this enticing girl must go. With what reluctance you watch her slip away in her beribboned coat out over a tawny hill. And what stolen glee it gives me to let you glimpse her now. But there were real people with whom you struck a chord and forged a bond. So many of them along the way. Casting the fictive girl aside, you have an urge to document all your friendships with in-the-flesh girls. Charlotte, the forthright friend with whom you made sit-upons in the second grade. Snaggle-toothed Lucy, the chum with whom you played bare-naked Barbies in the fourth. And on and on. You want to celebrate them all, for you were rich in friends. Yes, that's another way to look at it all. You were rich in friends. Not all the friendships were abject. And they got healthier with time. What a relief to tell at last a happy tale. But hold on just a minute, young lady. Is the memoirist allowed a happy tale? You're suddenly swamped by doubters, by contrarians. Should this story really be one of triumph over obstacles, a Hollywood plot? Wouldn't a French meander of endless suggestion and inconclusive despair be more to the point? And what about this girl of yours? Should she be the valiant lass who can sail any sea, or the grieving waif clasping her poetry books and memory cases? What if you're emphasizing happiness too much or too little? This is a myth you're constructing, you know. Take it seriously. It may be writ in stone. So what would be the most beneficial myth, you wonder, and for whom? Is it just for you or your offspring? For women, for men, for the world? Should it provoke, contradict, break taboos, or confirm, soothe, and repair? This muddle threatens to deep six you for good. until you recall, as your billionfold forebears have said, the writer's foremost job: turn trouble to beauty. So yes, it turns out, if balanced, if earned, you may have your happy tale. Returning to the point you were making before this rude interruption, fool second guessers, you were rich in friends, and they may form a part of your account, of your happy account. And boys, too, for they too were a joy in the end. First you were a wallflower, of course, but then the miracle occurred. And now you are suddenly rhapsodizing on the page about your first love. Quote, and then across by the gym, I saw him. He was sitting astride his red Kawasaki, just leaning there like glory. An arm dangled over the handlebars, a shoulder slanted, talking to Alex. His hand went up to brush a flop of hair out of his eye, and he tossed his gleaming head. There he was in all his majesty, this strobe, this glowing, candescent, lustrous, radiant, streaming, gleaming, pouring boy. And for a while you admit it, you are lost. Boys were the ones who made you feel you might, just might, be a viable quantity in the world. How good it feels to dwell here amongst the irises, your head in Will's lap, on a cool 1971 Tokyo evening. There is a drive toward healing in the writing of memoir, and it works. Somehow, miraculously, pain babies are napping now. Well-fed, satisfied that they've been heard and will have their rightful places, though you don't yet know quite how to arrange them in the text, they can stop their mewlings for the moment and doze. More peaceful yourself, your considerations about the narrative of the memoir take a turn toward geography. Places are mustering, the places you lost during the sea crossings of your youth. Babies jangling ankle bracelets in Borneo markets. Lotus-smelling Chinese babies being washed in tin buckets. And Dutch ones swaddled in wool, staggering along rainy cobbles. The places and scenes of the past demand to be reconfigured. You have a compulsion to time transport to places of old. And furthermore, those places want to be the story. Surely a portrait of each beloved culture could make a book. You want to write of the Hayama Sea crashing beside your baby pram, the Dutch cream puffs you bought at the bakery shop along with your mother's cigarettes. You want to describe the smell of sandalwood and fish and curry at the Kuching market, the way your Dutch nanny hugged you, the way you felt at home among Japanese tidy, hushed formalities. Places and cultures want to claim the story. You want to just paint them all back into existence. You must, you feel, be there once again via the page. Okay, places can have their place. And you will be allowed your comments about the meaning of Dutch pancakes within reason. But really, the places were the backdrop. You lived in those places. You weren't traveling through, and this is not a travel essay. The life is what you want to write, right? All right, already, the readers groan. Enough of this. Haven't we been patient long enough? Spies, they say, the spies. We want to hear about spooks and spies. The market wants spies, everyone tells you. People don't want to hear about a shy girl crying on a houseboat. Spies, yes, I know, you think, but I know so little. My father could tell me so little. But you pieced together a night when you were seven, when the house was suddenly a tingle with whispers. Your father was hiding a man in his study, a man whose life was threatened by Chiang Kai-shek. And you meet a journalist at a Washington, D.C. party who, it turns out, reported on the Hague confrontation between American and Dutch spies and the Red Chinese, in which your father had to have been involved. You do know he was the liaison with Dutch intelligence. And you begin to remember your father's notebooks, just bigger than matchboxes, and the early morning walks he took in European cities to meet mysterious men. And there was this defector your father spoke of. and a story begins to come together. And maybe the book can be about spying, in spite of your limited hard data. What spy, after all, let that stop him from whipping up a story in pursuit of truth? And your heart begins to sing. Maybe the word spy will catch hold of someone, and you will have a reader after all. For you are trying to communicate something, actually, if you can only figure out exactly what it is. But lest your head get too big or too dreamy, imagining that letter from that person who read your actual words, your old editor who has read some of your pages says, nope. I mean, yes, spies have to be important. They have to be a key thread in the story, but they can't carry the whole thing. Your father, unfortunately, was a good man with a conscience, not a rogue. And there are covert operations and recruitments of agents and defectors and nonsensical meddlings and the placing of others in danger and using people for American ends, yes, but no overt assassinations. It cannot be a spy thriller. Whoa, partner, you think to yourself, maybe you could just make up a few little tidbits to add to your father's tale or turn it into a novel about a ruthless spy. But once again, your conscience, so like your father's, speaks in its soberest tone. Are you here to summon the truth, that rarest of things, or to try to fabricate a beach book for money, which has never been your biggest thrill? And your heart goes flop. So much for the letter from the reader. And maybe, you rally, it is about your father, his life, the torment his work caused him, and how secrecy harmed him. It might be about his identity, his emotional cascade, his increasing disillusionment about his work, his agency, his country. It might track the handsome philosophical father you watched transform over the course of your childhood, from the exuberant Mandarin speaker, idealistic about saving the world from Hitler's, jabbering in Chinese over soy sauce splashed dumplings, to the bicycle riding Holland dweller in a tweed cap besotted with World War I museums, to the weary man back at headquarters frustrated at the promotion that doesn't come, complaining about the office mafia, to the man hissing to your mother in the back hall of the Tokyo house, I feel like I'm prostituting myself, I should just go to the other side, to the cynic sitting by the Saigon embassy pool waiting for the Viet Cong to arrive as the ambassador claims victory is just ahead, to the silent, depressed retiree deprived of his chosen career, deprived by his chosen career of his very own emotions, how he was always a man of mist. The book could be about, as you write in the manuscript, how the duplicity, the secrets, the covert actions of dubious moral or practical value that put others' lives at risk became a heavier and heavier burden until they weighted down his pockets like stones. And your relationship with him, how he taught you to love art and words and truth, how he was always your champion, even if not his own. What torture it was to watch him suffer and how you adored him. Yes, certainly it is a father-daughter story. This and the spies, you think, your heart thumping, are leading you closer to the narrative's heart. But me, shrieks your mother, as she always did in real life. I want to be the one. Yikes, this was compelling. And for a while she had the bit in her mouth. There was lots to describe here. Her daring, her parachuting, her work with lepers and the poor, and all those vicious arguments between you. You will, I won't. But this was too large a story, this mother-daughter affair, a story that would fill the world. No, no, not about her, nor your brother either. He's another outsized tale, though they both appear. You managed to force them back into their jack-in-the-boxes. They can have their own stories some other time, maybe. But some other sizable babies are now squawking. Can there possibly be more? History and politics and American foreign relations all want to strut. Be a work of history, they urge. Such is the only book worth its paper. You hear your father and all the men you worshipped growing up with their authoritative, manly voices sounding off, wanting things perceived their way. You draw up all of your female self who did not major in history at Yale and say, it's there, as the important backdrop to it all, you say, but that's not my story, the one only I can tell. But now a red, white, and blue cherub squeals with all its lusty might, trying to out-blare the rest. What it means to be American is surely the story here, it says. What it means to be an American in this world. This is the tale to track. What it was to be the American baby you in post-occupation Japan, where the subdued residents bowed hastily to passing Americans. Or the American grade schooler in Taipei, whose father was cavorting with paramilitaries. Or the American teeny bopper, you, in Ban the Bomb the Hague in the 60s, with the hippies of all hippies shouting at your father, fuck America, with your country's name spelt with a K. What about all sorts of proud and striding Americans, all the soldiers and spies, what they were doing in the world in the 50s and 60s? What does all that mean about being an American? Tell them about the roller coaster, the phase in which you wanted to wear red, white, and blue socks and shoes and underpants. And the other phase when things happened and you wanted to toss your passport in a puddle and slink away with your tail between your legs. Tell about loving and hating your nationality. You have a lot to say about that and how it changed with time. Now that would make a fine book, the starred and striped baby says. And for most of the years of writing, the book is titled American Girl, and it remains to a hefty degree about national identity, the obsession of the expatriate. Now three shyer but bright-colored babies start to bleat. Paintings! Yes, paintings, call out from their frames. We're what you love. Choose us, they say. A painting could accompany each chapter, each phase of your life. You could structure the book around us. How tempting, how lovely the idea of dwelling there among the paint pots and tubes and easels, the rubies and lapis lazuli, the beautiful faces on canvas. You could happily just trail off after works of art. Your story could be written through them. And paintings do appear, and drawings as well, but in their places on museum walls, not as portraits come alive at Hogwarts. Then your various schools start to squawk. The tiny American school of The Hague, that Victorian manse with its would-be tumble of oil company, Dutch, and military kids. And Washington, D.C.'s Sidwell Friends School, realm of the power elite, the cool beyond cool. And Canadian Academy, that missionary boarding school in Japan, odd and strangely comforting at 16 and never been kissed. They want their share of attention. You could analyze schools and how different ones fashion you into different people, how the culture of a school can make or break, and how some of them that seem at first to break, in fact, make. You could yammer on about the chimpanzee hierarchies of schools and of your apparently infinite capacity for a sense of inferiority. But you've already done that. And now, clothing. Yes, items with which you drape your body threaten to take over the book. For you love describing 60s get-ups. Wigwam feathers, bare tooth pendants, railroad striped jeans, Indian dresses with mirrors embroidered on. A good friend's heart sings at all the vestments. Your old editor, however, says, cease and desist, please. Spare me the bracelets and capes. Uh-oh, not so fast, says your husband when you pronounce that the book is about father and country. The psychiatric ward. That is what's going to sell this book. I've always said you should lead with that. A 16-year-old anti-war protester with waist-length hair the sole female on an Air Force ward full of shell-shocked guys returning from Vietnam with their minds blasted out? What could be more fascinating than that? You think. Yes, this is part of the story, a turning point. But again, like the spies, it doesn't deliver the expected punch. Ward 3 and those struggling GIs were the grace of it all, not the horror. They don't fit the expected plot. But now you, like your readers or listeners, are limp on the ground in a fetal position, scrunching worm-like back toward the womb, while the babies are clamoring and bouncing and crowing with glee. They adore the cut and thrust of battle, fighting for their lives, and the thrill of conquering. "We downed her," their chortles say, these imps, these scallywags, these confusion dribblers of your mind. "She'll never have a book now," they squeal in unison. Babies, after all, are maybe the most powerful humans, it occurs to you, as you curl tight into your defeat, longing for a bottle and some covers to pull over your head. You stay there, curled tight and hiding, a turtle in a shell, safe for the time being from the platoon of mewling and yowling infants, until you regain some strength and consider a new approach. And one day, girded and decided at last, you don your armor, take your sword in hand, for the babies, you've learned, are really dragons of the mind, and prepare for war. You know you have too much to say, too many babies in your mind, and you haven't the foggiest how to sort them out, but now they're all identified and you're determined. You will, come locusts or floods or over your own dead body, give each baby a sort of due, a home, and craft some kind of story of it all. You experiment, you essay, you put one baby in command, then another. You line them up this way and that. You feed one and burp another and put a third to bed. They squabble, you separate them, you throttle one near to death. You ambush, you sneak attack, you try dirty tricks. You rend your helmet and tear out your graying and thinning hair. You think you have it, you think you really do, but damn and blast, it all collapses again, and you hurl the pages down. And later, after a month's sleep, you creep back. Some of the babies are thankfully dozing, so the odds are slightly in your favor, and try again. And in the end, finally, somehow, truly wondrously, you've worn both yourself and the babies to a nub. You, the adult, the birthing has nearly killed you. You have a story in your hand. And the infants are finally sated. They're asleep in their cribs. And it's as if none of it has ever happened. Postscript. You listeners want, I expect, for me to tell you, to give you some guidance in dealing with the ruckusing babies of your own memoirs. Here's my advice. Listen to them. Tend to them one by one. You can't hurry them or they'll tantrum. Let each have his or her howl. Realize these babies are like actual human siblings. You, as parent or victim, love them all the same, but each has different needs. And you have to prioritize like any head of household if you want to make a narrative that works. Mammals are prone to hierarchies, and you can't escape this genetic predisposition. Unless you want to present a haphazard mess of howlers on the page, which is a legitimate option. Research has established that authoritative, rather than either laissez-faire or authoritarian parents, are the most effective. So use your power with love and give your baby some structure. You are the parent, no matter what they might think. So, as for the babies, this one needs to be in the lead right now, front and center. Two or three others need to be given key supporting roles. Some will be featured in set pieces or work in set design. Others will have crawl-on parts. The rest offered as sideshows and mentions. As in a play, each little chub will have his or her spot in the script in which to shine. Be stern with your babies. Be kind. Tell this one he'll have to wait. That one, she'll get her say at the end of the book. One, you can appease with a banana. Another with a promised trip to Six Flags when he's older. Give them their places like a firm and knowing parent, and they'll be happy. They'll sort it out. They'll grow up. Well, maybe some won't. One or two may be chronically dissatisfied. But don't let the guilt stall you. Maybe someone else will write their story. And there's always the psychotherapist chamber. The thing is, once you know your narrative, clasp it tight and brandish your sword. If you are sure, the babies will feel secure. The babies will shut up at last. All of this, this grasping, hair pulling, and utter despair to come up with this simple beginning to my book. I was born under an assumed name. It was in Kamakura that my parents first went under. Mr. Brown, a colleague, met them at the Tokyo airport after the endless flights from Washington. As he was driving them the 40 miles to Kamakura near the coast, he asked them to select a surname. Once they arrived at their new home, nestled into a mountain slope beneath an ancient three-story high Buddha, they settled into their new identity. That's the story of the story of my memoir. So. I wanted to give you all a chance to think about your babies a little bit. So I'm handing out a sheet where I thought I'd just give you like 5 minutes to jot down some of the different elements of your memoir or what you're writing. And then I have a number of other sort of thinking points here that you can think about later if you want to. But I thought I'd give you the time now just to think about it for 5 minutes or so. So I'll hand this around.
Yeah. What is the difference, or the core difference between the memoir and the personal essay?
Well, it's, I guess my take on that is memoir can vary from more story-like to more essay-like. So for me, memoir can be either one. Generally, the essay has sort of more reflection and thinking in it, a little more telling, and the story, like one, you know, showing may predominate. But the truth is, both of them have quite a lot of reflection. So it's, you know, also you might think, you know, personal essay obviously is a shorter form, but memoirs can also have little essays within them, and so. Anyway, I hope that helps.
Also, on my website, I have an article about all the subgenres of queer nonfiction you might want to look at. It's also in the back of Fearless Confessions, for those of you who have that. My website is SueWilliamsSilverman.com. Scroll down on the right, and you'll see something called the Meandering River. Just click on that, and also pop up.
That's great. So if you want to take... I'm happy to take some more questions, but I wanted to give you a chance to just think for a few minutes before you go out into the hubbub again about what your memoir might contain. I mean, just for those of you who don't have it, it just involves listing all the babies, and then you can get the other questions later, all of your babies.
Okay.
minute. Okay, I hope you got something down that's useful. A good muddle to to work with, yeah.
I have a question. When you're talking about finding the story and exploring all of these different possibilities, as you are finding your story, which sounds like a study that's coming back to, is it usually the most overarching theme that sort of flies over everything, like the essence of the journey that encapsulates everything else? Or how do you pick that largest thread? How do you figure out what is the guide?
Yeah, it is just so hard. It's so hard. I mean, maybe Sue has something to say too. For me, it was just, it really was a matter of trying out these different threads and, you know, seeing which ones worked and which ones worked with each other. And there really wasn't any easy way. I mean, I'm giving you this handout to hopefully help you make it easier. But if you can sort of really think hard about what your major conflict is, you know, what's the real story? What's the real story? That will help you get closer to the driving line that's going to work. But to me, it just seems like just a trial and error process. And you know, trying it out on a couple of trusted people. What would you say, Sue, about how to find it?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is trial and error, of course. But as you say, it's first of all, as you say too, knowing that you can always save the material that doesn't fit for the next book and the next one, and you know, you can basically probably write about yourself forever, as self-involved as that may seem, nevertheless.
Yeah,
you can still do it. But I mean, it is finding that one thread, and if it doesn't, basically, if it does not feed that one thread, leave it out.
Yeah.
I mean, because you've really got to stay on on that kind of straight path, and just know that, you know, do just save it. But, you know, find that focus, I tend to write out sort of like a thesis statement. And of course it's going to change over time, but that's fine. But I kind of like take it to the computer almost and say, okay, it's about, I'm going to explore this conflict between, you know, this and that, or I'm going to, discover, how I spoke this, mute language, silent language growing up in an incestuous family, and everything then is going to have to tie to that. So it's like, sort of like, too, like, what are you going to prove? I want to prove that because this happened, that happened, you know, that kind of cause and effect. That's really key, you know, because, like, if one event doesn't cause anything else to happen, that's a dead end. But if one event causes the next, then you start building that kind of pathway through your story. And just stay on that pathway then. And if it doesn't fit, you know, just put it up. I literally have a file that says, you know, future material. You know, and I just basically lump it all in there in a big mess. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just finished an essay collection, and I'm starting another one. And there's just, like, stuff I never, you know, so don't feel like you have to cram it all in. Yeah.
Yeah, I had to you know, literally my mother started to take over the book. And, you know, she's such a, people would say to me, well, your mother's the real story. I mean, your mother's the nightmare in your life. You know, you should write about that. But I, you know, I, well, for one thing, I realized I couldn't do all of it in one book. And yeah, I finally just got to, you know, the idea of tracking these two parallel identity stories, that of me and of my father. So my identity sort of gets better and better, and his gets worse and worse. And it's also about each of our relationship to America. So those became the dominant threads. And then, as Sue was saying, the other stuff you make subordinate. And then some things have to go, obviously. You know, I had to, you know, get rid of a lot of painting stuff. And, yeah, just all kinds of things had to be kept for later. But it takes a while to just figure out which thing is going to be the dominant story. But keep, you know, keep writing to yourself this, what is this, this story is really about, and write to yourself.
You know, the other thing is think about voice, because when you start hearing like your voice is sounding different, then that's probably another story. Like in my first memoir, at first I thought, well, of course I'll throw the sex addiction in there, because of course it's that above, you know, sitting here talking about sex addiction. But anyway, that's where we are. So I'm writing about incest and thinking, well, you know, of course there's that is a cause and effect, but the voice starts sounding different. Because you had a wounded child sounding voice in the one, and a sort of tough, you know, a tougher sort of sex sounding voice in the other. And those two voices, no way they were going to fit. It just literally sounded different. So then I thought, okay, another book. And so that energy starts shifting, and that is another sort of, like a red flag that can go up. So just listen to the voice.
Yeah.
I also just add to that that sometimes you can be writing one story, and you can also be writing another story that is in parallel with it, or is the undertow. I thought I was originally writing about my family, and really what I was writing was a story with a beginning, middle, and end, of which my family played a huge role, and that became a secondary narrative, but only insofar as it fit into the first overview.
It had to all feed
into that, but there's sort of two stories going on there.
So
and
keeping,
it's
just keeping asking, asking every bit of material. Do you serve my my major purpose? Yeah, sorry.
Well, that's right. I was just saying I can relate to that myself. I mean, I've been in the program now for a year, and I started working with Sue my first semester. And an essay that I wrote and presented to her that to look over started out like 25 pages, and I thought that all these, you know, different things were related to the same theme. Now has split into four different essays, and just in the course of sitting here listening to this lecture, now it might be six essays. It's hard to control all that stuff because as soon as it starts to get a mind of its own, it'll do what it wants, all the material.
I always say when you start a memoir, it's like when you just start writing a memoir, you put everything into it, including the kitchen sink. I mean, it's just it just tends to have all your issues in it. All, so it's
sort of the opposite of fiction. You know, when you start with fiction, you start with a clean slate. And what can I add? Mm-hmm. You know, in a writing creative nonfiction, your plate is really messy. It's got everything on it. So what can I sort of scrape off the plate? Yeah.
And there's no telling what you're going to discover and see.
That's exactly right. And a lot of it really is, you just have to try it and see what's important.
Well, staying with your baby metaphor here. Once you have the baby and you know they're in the crib where they're up messing around, how do you raise them after that? Like, you know, you got to revise it. So once you get them all, like, what's your process? Because that's where I am now. I really need to know how to start getting these babies grown and out of my house.
Funny. Well, have you chosen your main thread?
Yes.
Or you have? Okay. So
I think.
Yeah. Okay. So as we were saying before, you've got to figure out which babies really, you know, are on that train, or, you know,
No, that's not a good metaphor anyway. who feed that, feed into that driving line. And then you've got to, put the other ones to rest. You put them in your, well, Anne Lamott calls it her goddess file, her the stuff she has to take out of her. Of her books.
No, I mean, like, I know which babies are in.
Oh, you
my
know which
train.
Ones are in. Okay.
So I'm trying to figure out now how to raise them. To revise them and get them. You know, I know which ones are there. I'm okay with that. I'm just wondering about your process once you run it all together.
Well, then, God, it's just such a relief. And you get to have the fun part, which is, really working on.
Everybody says that, but it's not that fun for me right now.
Yeah.
People say that's so much fun, and I'm not having fun.
What things are struggles for you?
I just can't even look at it.
Well, you maybe need a rest. Oh, gosh. Yeah. Well, I love it when it does get to that stage. And some people love the generating stage, and other people like the sort of more refining the story and the more polishing of scenes. And, I mean, I love working with language. So that's kind of the next stage for me, once you've got the damn pieces in place, to enjoy... adding more sensory detail and concrete detail and playing with your phrasing and, all the little parts of writing, the more minute level, line level and stuff. Make coloring up your characters and all that stuff. So all those tools of the trade, then you get to apply them, those fictional tools. So that's what I would say. All right. Well, thank you, everyone.